This episode is sponsored by State Farm. You a small business owner looking for insurance that fits your needs and budget? Well, look no further than State Farm. State Farm agents are not just insurance providers. They're also small business owners who live and work right here in your community. They understand the unique challenges of running and protecting a small business. When it comes to small business insurance, State Farm knows what it takes. Create a plan that fits your needs and your budget. State Farm agents are ready to help you choose personalized policies that truly understand your business. Insure your small business with a fellow small business owner. Talk to a State Farm agent today and get started on personalized small business insurance that fits your needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
OG, I know you're already a member, but I wonder if the rest of our audience knows that becoming a member at Navy Federal Credit Union could help you save and earn more. Their certificate options could earn you more than standard savings accounts with competitive rates. Not all financial institutions offer you as many choices for savings options as Navy Federal does. For example, you could start your savings journey with a low minimum deposit, add money at any time, and watch your savings grow. Thanks to flexible terms, you can use Navy Federal's savings option for all kinds of goals, short or long term. Considering a big home improvement project, maybe you want to consolidate debt. You could borrow up to 100% of your home's equity with a fixed-rate home equity loan with zero closing costs, or easily borrow as you go with a home equity line of credit. Both options could help make life's big expenses seem more manageable. To learn more, visit NavyFederal.org. At Navy Federal, our members are the mission. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender. Membership required. Terms and conditions apply. Loan subject to approval.
Hey, Stackers, you know, just like the gym, the bar down the street, and the Sizzler, we're going to have to cancel the podcast because what's that, Joe? What? Okay, fine, I'll take the mask off.
What's that? Oh, you're saying it's less than 10 people? And since we have two listeners, so we're okay? We can do anything we want? We just keep doing what we're doing, just entertain people? Yes, we can totally do this, people. This is a go. Let's light this candle.
Live from Joe's mom's basement, it's the Stacking Benjamin Show. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and happy second day of spring, Stackers. I love it when we can finally open up a basement window and share with the world the smell of old pizza and takeout. Today, we'll jump into not just spring cleaning the basement, but spring cleaning your money. What should you do? Here to help us, we welcome from the Paychecks and Balances podcast, Marcus Garrett. Plus, from Afford Anything, Paula Pant. And from LenPenzo.com, it's Marie Kondo. Nah, even she'd give up on this mess. It's just Len Penzo. Plus, speaking of cleaning, is it time to think about cleaning up how you save? Joining us on a special Friday segment, we welcome Dr. Ted Klontz and from Ally, Emily Shalal. Of course, that's not all. We'll also magnify someone's money situation and save time for my incredible trivia. And now a guy who probably needs to air out some shoes, Joe Salsiha.
It is usually a great day to air out some running shoes. Hey, everybody, welcome to It Doesn't Smell Here Anymore. I'm Joe Salsiha, Average Joe Money on Twitter, and OG taking a well-deserved break, which means today in the first chair, deep under Los Angeles, it's our good friend Len Penzo.
Wow, I'm honored. The first chair. I mean, I can't remember last time I've been first chair, Joe. Thanks.
No pressure, man. You got to bring it.
Speaking of smelly stuff, you know, it's been a long winter and it's been getting smelly here in the bunker. So I'm looking forward to some springtime freshness.
Isn't it great? Finally time to get rid of that gold bullion smell.
Yes.
I love how, by the way, when the market starts dropping All I have on my Twitter feed is Len Penzo's finally winning over and over and over. That's all people told me.
Well, that's very nice. I appreciate everybody's enthusiasm for me. I've got a long ways to go, Joe. I've been hurt so bad over the years.
I wasn't ever in high school band. Were you in high school band, Len?
No, unless you count third grade. Yes, that's not high school.
That's not high school.
I was in the band.
That's some killer math you got there.
Music in third grade. But no, I was not in high school band.
No, but you know, they challenge for the chairs. I knew I was a junior high trombone player, and there's a challenge. And possibly challenging you halfway through this podcast for that first chair from Las Vegas. It's our friend Paula Pant.
It is me. I am here. And Las Vegas, springtime starts at the beginning of February. I just got to say, it's been spring for ages.
Boy, that's great, Paula. That's fantastic. says the guy in Detroit.
You know, I'm going to take every opportunity to brag about the weather before the temperatures turn to like 115 degrees.
I was just thinking that. I was thinking in July, I'm going to turn that table on you.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm milking it while I can.
Another guy who's in deep in the heart of Texas from the Paychecks and Balances podcast here to save the show. Marcus Garrett. How are you, man?
I'm doing well. I'm in Houston, Texas now. I think I was in Austin last time we spoke.
Yeah. You see, they finally kicked you out of town.
Yeah, man. They ran me out. I can only stay in a city about a few years. So, you know,
you wear out your welcome. And well, luckily Houston is huge. It's easy to disappear in Houston.
That's the theory.
Yeah. So tell everybody about, there might be three people listening that don't know Paychecks and Balances. Tell them what you and our good friend Rich do on the show.
Yeah, my culprit and co-host, Rich Jones, works for an unnamed but large search engine in the Silicon Valley area. And I am in Houston, Texas, and we both co-host Paychecks and Balances, where we help millennials make money, save money, and get out of debt on the smooth sounds of BNB.
Paula, that drives me crazy.
What a perfect radio voice.
He's going to talk like that the whole damn show.
Perfect radio voice. I am in love.
I re-upped the mic and the setup just for this.
Len is driving to Houston right now. While he's driving, by the way, if the honeybee's with him, she could be reading the Stacker. He should. He's got to keep his eyes on the road. The Stacker is our Stacky Benjamin's email. You will get not only lessons from all the ways that I messed up my money over the years and the lessons I learned from it, but then you'll also get anything related to Stacky Benjamin's on tour, where we're going to be, meetups that we'll have, stackybenjamins.com/stacker. We got a great show because we got Marcus Garrett from Paychecks and Balances with us. We got Paula, we got Len. So let's get this party started.
Hello, darlings. And now it's time for your favorite part of the show, our Stacking Benjamin's headlines.
Our piece today comes from The Balance. It's written by Miriam Caldwell, How to Spring Clean Your Finances. Paula, I think I'll start with you because I look down through all of these things, much like we're cleaning out the basement this week. Cleaning out your spring finances is a pretty good idea.
You know, this list honestly is kind of generic. Dust off your budget and make sure you get out of debt. Like, it's all really basic personal finance 101.
But don't you think
have a budget, pay off your debt.
Yeah,
blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. But not all personal finance has to be niche and go 100 miles deep. I think there's a huge number of people here that need to learn these very basic lessons about money.
Well, I don't know. I mean, so one of the tips in this article is pay off your debt. But like, let's be a little bit more thoughtful about this. First of all, when we say debt, what are we referring to? Are we talking about your mortgage? If so, is it a good idea to pay that off? Or should you hold on to your mortgage so that you can invest that money into index funds instead and arbitrage the relative difference in the interest rates? There's a lot of, there is a lot of nuance and thought that needs to go on around a lot of these tips.
Sure. So let's dive into that one since you brought it up. The second paragraph says, and I think they went with a generic title, but it says, that's why you should set up a debt payment plan today. A lot of people have debt. Very few people actually have a debt strategy, a debt payoff strategy.
Well, yeah, I certainly agree. Having a thoughtful strategy, even if that strategy means that you're intentionally going to hold on to certain debts like your mortgage while aggressively paying off other debts like your credit card, certainly having a thoughtful strategy is necessary. But a blanket statement like pay off your debt, I don't think does very much good.
Len, when Paula says pay off your debt, first thing you think is paying off the mafia, don't you? Your mafia debt?
Well, if you value your legs, yeah, I think that's a great idea as pay off the mafia debt first.
Interest rate or highest payment first? Which one do you go with? Their highest balance, lowest balance? Do you ascribe one way or over another?
Well, the Dave Ramsey fans are going to hate me, but I say do the highest interest first. It's just a pure math thing. I've always ascribed to that. It makes the most sense from a monetary perspective, but I guess people will argue that there are some who want the psychological satisfaction of retiring individual debts, getting rid of those small balances, regardless of interest rate.
How do you, if you do it your way, you know, the thing about the Ramsey way is you get those little wins, right? If you pay off the high interest rate debt and do it better mathematically, how do you stay mentally engaged in that game when maybe it's one of the biggest debts you have?
Well, to me, I think the first thing you have to do is you have to understand the bad parts of interest and why interest is so insidious in trying to maintain your good personal finance, your personal finances in good standing, in good shape. So if you understand that interest is something that's really terrible, you would want to get rid of as much of that interest and stop paying as much of it as fast as you can. And the way to do that is to stop paying the higher interest debt first. But if you're looking at the big picture and you're just looking at the balance that you owe in debt, then get rid of those little wins, as you say. Get as many little wins under your belt. Make yourself feel good. If that works, then do it. But like I said, if you're looking at this from purely a monetary perspective, it is a no-brainer to get rid of the higher interest loans first.
Marcus, when you paid off debt, how did you do it?
I did what felt good, which is probably the same way I got into debt. So I like to do with, I have a whole 4-step plan, and it's pretty much all the other plans, whether it's 7 baby steps or a 4-step plan, which I use. But when I first started getting out of debt, I literally just I had a whatever plan. So anytime I had more money, I just put something towards the minimum. And I finally saw something at a zero balance. And it felt good to see a balance at zero after 7 years of not really making any dents in any payments. And it really showed me that a plan could work. Then I went out and looked at the calculators and the debt calculators and put like a time frame and a timeline to it. But I mean, honestly, I don't think it would have ever worked for me to just go out and tackle it and be responsible.
You had to be interested first.
Yes.
Yeah.
And motivated. And so the motivator for me was seeing a debt payment paid off. I think the first one I tackled, I want to say, was a used car with rims. I had my taste that I had gotten a few years earlier, and I paid that off. And it was just, okay, this works. Just seeing something that works.
Let's go over. We started with the one that Paula thought was stupid. Let's talk about the rest of these. Sweep out old spending habits. Marcus, how about for you? Spending habit that has been a big win for you, curtailing?
So we should have began that I'm an auditor. So I tend to go negative because I'm going to go negative right here. That's why I'm disclaiming accordingly. I was trying to save like $50 the other month, and I'm like so close to the bone right now. There's no more fat to cut. Like, actually, I did not discover it, I might add. Like, I spent the whole month like, okay, I just want to, you know, save somewhere in my budget like $50. I couldn't find it. Like, there's no more fat to cut. And I only share that story because I think some people, like, once you get really lean, it gets like you have to make more. You have to kind of find a way. So sweeping out old spending habits, like, I guess my all the skeletons are out of the closet. Like, I don't got anything left to sweep. And so I'm sure the listening audience does, but I don't have one for this one. I'm living at the margins, man.
Yours is all swept out.
Exactly.
So now for you, then, it's all, and I think you mentioned this, but I want to draw attention to it. For you, it's just make more money.
Yeah. I mean, I could go. I mean, there's probably people, like, if they saw where I live on a Google map, they'd be like, yeah, he can definitely downgrade from there. But, like, I also feel like that's something that I've earned over time as well. There's definitely things that I could cut, but they're not things that I want to. I can't do the traditional things that I did, like, during the book, like cut cable. Cable's been cut off for like 12 years now. I cut back on rent. I had a roommate. I don't want a roommate anymore. So some of these are like lifestyle choices and changes, but like they're not things I can just easily opt into like I could when I was 22, 23 going through that journal. There was actually a lot more fat to cut at that time.
A lot of these big expenses, Paula, that a lot of people talk about cutting that you read about a lot,
you know, in boring pieces like this. The sorry. I thought I was pretty funny there. You never had a lot of those habits. Did you ever have cable?
No. As an adult, I have never had cable. My parents had it when I was a child, but I, as a from the age of 18 onward, have never had cable.
Big overspending at restaurants? Ever have that one?
For a little while I did. That was probably one of my bigger weaknesses, particularly, I would say, in my early 30s. That one has dropped down pretty significantly lately over the past 2 years. But you know what's interesting is sometimes when you cut spending in a certain category, it's possible to replace it with spending in a different category, which means that overall you haven't actually saved any money. You have changed your spending habits, but you've simply just transferred spending in one category to another. So for example, restaurants. In my early 30s, yeah, I think I spent quite a bit more on restaurants. For the last 2 years, that's dropped quite a bit. But in the last 2 years, I've spent a great deal more money at Sephora getting hair conditioning treatments and things like that. So for all the money that I've saved at restaurants, I've just transferred it over to like skincare.
Len's nodding aggressively. Len, you're getting hair treatments.
Regeneration treatments is what I was nodding my head towards.
Yeah, that's pretty expensive stuff. But this one is interesting, though, Len, because I think about Paula, who never developed a lot of those habits and started early. And Marcus talking about, you know, there's some expenses that he doesn't want to change. I think that the older you are, the harder it is to change some of those big expensive habits. Like, I think it's easier for young people listening to this to never move into a big house than it is for people already live in a big house and they love their big house or they love their neighborhood or wherever they live. That downgrading for them is much more difficult than never having it at all.
Well, yeah. House, I mean, that's a big thing. You can't just pack up and move. It takes a lot of effort. So yeah, that would definitely get you set in your ways. And there's things you can't do. I think the people who drink coffee have a hard time. It's so easy to say, oh, stop the Starbucks. There are people that are just totally addicted. I mean, they will not stop because they are convinced that that's the only way they're going to drink their coffee. So that too. I mean, I have my issues though too. I mean, I've caught myself with my model trains. There was a point there where I was spending $100 a week on my model train stuff, honest to God. You know, so I had to kick back and say, hey, back off, dude. You know, I know you can afford it, but you gotta back off.
I think it would have been funnier if you had like a family model train intervention. Like everybody sat you down and went, Len, this is the caboose of this whole thing.
And you know, the irony is somebody had wrote me actually this week talking about my model train stuff. And I was telling them all that stuff is still in my closet of the thousands and thousands of dollars I have invested in it. I don't even have the dumb thing built.
My sister-in-law has several purses in her closet that she's never used. Len has Bachmann models in his.
Well, hey, how about this now? You brought women in shoes. My grandmother, you know, God rest her soul, she must have had 400 pairs of shoes, you know, she had collected over the years.
But I was having
just amazing.
I was having a talk yesterday with it was a guy in shoes. I mean, collected really, really nice fashionable shoes. And somebody like 6 months ago that we had on the show was talking about, you know, I mean, how expensive some of the, you know, the cool new athletic shoe endorsed by the latest superstar has. I remember driving down the road when we were in New Orleans and there was a huge line outside of Adidas the day that a new brand of Adidas shoe was coming out. And I looked at the price of that shoe and it was not going to be cheap. Like that was going to be a huge amount of money. Dusting off your budget was number two on this list. I want to ask you guys about how you budget. Do you use, like I, you know, talk about how I use Tiller Money all the time for my budget. I use that to track it. And then we have a weekly family meeting, Cheryl and I, either over wine or pancakes, depending on what time of day it is. Len, how do you keep a budget?
Yeah, I don't have an official budget anymore. I mean, those days are gone, but I do track my spending religiously and we do review it. The Honeybee and I, we do that once a month.
Do you use an app? Do you use an app to do that?
Like no, it's not very efficient, really. I mean, but it works remarkably well. We just use an Excel spreadsheet. And the Honeybee takes all the payment information. Most of it, you know, we pay most of the bills online. So that you look it up and then she transfers it to the Excel worksheet. I started that back in 1997. That spreadsheet, my spreadsheet is 23 years old. So, and it's extremely complex. So, I'm not going to change.
Yeah.
It works for us.
Sure. No, Marcus, do you use an app?
Yes, I have Mint on my phone. I say that hesitantly because it's like a paperweight. I check in like quarterly or something to that effect. I did set up a budget in there. And I was going to say, it's just going to sound very, the word that I can't think of. But if you Googled Marcus Garrett 50-30-20, there is an article about the 50-30-20. And I use that article because it has a free budgeting tool in there that you can use. It's right there in the article. It's for NerdWallet. And so, I mean, I think something to what we're speaking to is I use an 80-20 budget now. Like I save 20 and I don't think about the rest of the 80. So it's very simple for me, but I had to earn the privilege to do that. So the problem that I was having with the $50 was like a self-made problem. I actually just thought it would be cool to, I forget what I was even trying to find the $50 for. But then I went and pulled out my budget and I was like, I can't even find $50 to cut. It's not that I didn't have $50, but I couldn't find it somewhere easily to cut. There was no, like I said, the cable bill to cut off, or I'll just cut back on electricity because I've done all those things and they're so instilled in my habits now. Like when we were talking about the 400 shoes, I think I have 6.
Yeah.
I probably had 2 of those for about 3 years. So,
yeah.
My girlfriend's probably not proud of that, but I'm like, that's just not my thing. And so, like, maybe this is just a long summation of maybe I'm too boring and I need to find ways to spend money again. But yeah, I like a 80-20 budget now. I started with the 50-30-20 when I was struggling to get out of the budget. And I guess get out of debt. And I guess to hit on that, I'm going through that. Like people know 50% is for needs, 30% for wants, and 20% is either paying down debt or doing something responsible. So now my 20% typically just goes towards paying for retirement or something towards retirement. I do something responsible with 20% of the money. I have fun with 80%.
Yours, Paula, I think is save first also, right?
Yes, exactly. My strategy is figure out what percentage of your income or what raw dollar amount of your income you want to save. Pull that off the top first and then just go wild with the rest. So, and I do that. You know, in the past, I've used Mint or Personal Capital. I've kind of flirted in and out of those off and on for years, but I found it to be difficult to stick to long term. With Mint, a lot of times they mislabel a certain expense. And so I have to go in and make all of these corrections. And so it becomes very manual and very tedious and very time consuming. And what I finally came to realize is that at the end of the day, it really doesn't matter if I'm spending this money on food versus entertainment versus, you know, pets or whichever category I'm spending it in. Spending is spending and savings is savings. And if the point of budgeting is to make sure that you're saving enough, then let's cut to the chase. Just figure out how much you want to save, yank that off the top, and spend the rest. Ta-da, you're done.
But for people that they're just starting out though, Paula, I hear a lot of people in our community love things like YNAB. Like if you have debt and you're not good at knowing how to not get into debt and save enough, and you're not really sure where your money's going to a zero-based program, I think for those people, that's a great thing.
Oh, yeah. I think certainly if your budget is super tight or you're trying to pay off debt or you're just new to this or you want a periodic check-in, you know, for all of those times, strict line itemized budgeting makes sense. And I've done that myself, you know, like I said, off and on for many, many years.
Yeah.
I just found it to be very hard to stick with consistently week after week, month after month, over the span of a decade.
That's the way, Len, yours used to be too, I think, wasn't it? Very zero-based budget.
Yes, it was. Yeah. Oh, yes, it was. Very much so. And then, you know, just one of the advantages of getting old and seeing your income rise over time and your that becomes less and less important. But yeah, it's very important in the beginning.
Marcus, the last one on here is a plan for your future. And I really like that one. I mean, not because spring cleaning is a great time to plan for your future, but I think if you don't have a plan, the best time to get one is now.
Yeah, I agree. And I think what I'm hearing as a theme here is if you're going to use these apps, if you're going to use these tools, for me, it was using them until I instilled these habits. So a lot of things that I do now, they're just second nature. Like, for example, when I'm walking through Target and all these temptations that people talk about and the Target discounts, I joke about that. But if it's not on my little list, so I maintain, we can go crazy here. So I do have Mint. I'm also looking at this calendar in the background, which is a whiteboard that I use, and I just update it because it's near the beginning of the month. I do that every month. And then I have a notepad in my phone of things I wants and needs. And so if it's not on my needs list, like that habit has been instilled over a decade now, it's really easy for me just to look at the list. Or I typically already have it memorized. And I just know that that thing that I'm seeing in Target is a want. I just keep on walking. And I think, it, again, that's come from 10 years of practice of instilling that habit. So I don't need to pull out Mint. I don't really need to know what my budget is doing because I've got it memorized because I've got 10 years of practice.
But the other thing I like about that is you've got surround sound. I mean, it sounds like wherever you look, you've surrounded yourself with these good reminders.
Right. And it did not by any stretch of the imagination occur overnight. Like, so I'm the guy, for those who don't know, and there's an article out there as well. I spent $26,000 in 72 hours. That's like what the book is about. The culmination of that story, both the lessons learned and how when you think you're going to ball out coming out of college and it doesn't quite go that way. And now, still not quite at baller status, but with significantly more income than the 22-year-old self that I have, like, it's bought a level of freedom. I mean, that's, I feel like that's something that sometimes people are hesitant to own. And like, I'm leaning in, like it's gotten me to a point where clearly I don't even have to think about those types of things anymore. But that is a privilege, steps that you have to take. And I think, have that come over time. So for those people who are starting off at the beginning, and I think we're going to hit a little bit later with the listener question is, you know, it, at least you can speak to the arc light at the end of the tunnel.
A responsible near baller.
Exactly.
Almost baller. Paula, you picked this article. So what's the big takeaway?
Oh, I picked this article. Did I?
I'm throwing you under the bus before you throw me under the bus.
I would say the big takeaway is to check in with yourself about how you're doing with the basics. What are your spending habits? How on track is your budget relative to where you want it to be? And if you have debts that you want to pay off, you know, do you have a strategy or a plan for that?
She's dropping the mic every comment.
I really am. Two more months of this.
Len?
I think the takeaway is, you know, it's what comes down to personal finance, which means this is all on you. You have to go back and do things yourself. You have to go back, look at your finances. They aren't going to take care of themselves. You have to do it for yourself.
Mr. Garrett is the guest. You got the last word, man.
For me, it's automate the process. So I make very few promises, but the time will pass on its own. So you can be 10 years older or 10 years further. Hopefully you'll be both.
I love it when we can not only talk about fintech, but also about behavior, because as you know, it isn't fees, it's not the market, it's not any of these things that will ensure your success. It's what you do. And so Ally was working on some behavioral economic ideas. How do they make products that people are more likely to use? And at the same time, Dr. Ted Klontz, they found, has been working on many of the same things. Of course, Dr. Klontz is a noted money psychologist, and his goal has been to help people think differently about savings. In fact, his big message has always been that we're not wired to save, so we have to kind of trick ourselves into it. Maybe we'll talk to him about that today. So today, we're going to talk to Dr. Ted Klontz and Emily Shalal from Ally about better money behaviors and some of the things that Ally's done to put that into practice. Emily Shalal and Dr. Ted Klontz on My Dad Shortwave. And joining us, it's Emily Shalal and Dr. Ted Klontz. How are you guys?
Great.
Sunshine and, yeah.
It's a beautiful day here in Detroit, Michigan. Let's talk about saving. Dr. Klontz, I'd like to start with you here, because a lot of the work the Ally is doing that Emily and I will talk about here in just a moment is based on your work. I want to ask you this. You say that people aren't wired for saving. That's not the way our head works. Explain that. Why not?
Well, it comes from our historical background, our ancestors, and it's all about pleasure. We are all here today because the natural selection process resulted in, and it was almost a necessity in giving. So there, when we give or we don't keep, we actually feel better. It's better to give than receive, that whole thing. It's actually a genetic wiring. And that part of our brain has not received an update in 100,000 years. So it's still operating like that. And historically, it was essential for the survival of the clan or of the community or of the tribe. And in the really poor areas of our nation today, very poor, small communities, that's still what happens. There's a huge giveaway thing. If somebody's in distress, they have where I live, it's called a bring a dish. And they bring, the whole community comes together, everybody gets fed. And that's literally how they keep fed. So there's still elements of that. And it caused, and back in those days, that's how the community survived. The people who kept or were inclined to save or hoard or hide were considered to be threats to the existence of the tribe, and they were sanctioned up to the point of death. So those of us whose ancestors lived tended to be giving things away or not keeping things. We call it saving today. Back then, they were called hoarders, and they were actually used as examples of how not to be.
Is this why, Dr. Klontz, we see people, we often see these people that give a lot in society, and they also seem to be often very wealthy people. And people continually say on this show, the more I give, the more I receive. That's true for us today then?
Yes. There's more pleasure in getting rid of the money. Now, of course, what we've shaped that in our culture is give it to myself. So I'll buy a new car, right? And there is that pleasure thing. It's the same pleasure piece. And quite often, we aren't doing it for ourselves. We're doing it for our family or for the good of our community. 9/11 occurred, and the solution, our government solution was, we'll give you $500 to spend. Not $500 to save, but $500 to spend. And so our government is sort of organized around the spending thing. If everybody were of that percentage of people who hoarded, our entire economy would collapse if we actually were in that 13% that were the ancestors that were hoarders.
That actually were, yeah. That's so interesting. It makes me think of, you know, we talk a lot about keeping up with the Joneses. But on the other side, it sounds like based on what you're talking about, to some degree, we don't want the neighborhood to be embarrassed because we're behind. So we're right. Kind of giving to everybody else by keeping up.
Yeah, and that taps into another basic need, which is to belong. That's the most threatening thing to human beings, is to have a sense that they're not a part of the tribe or they don't belong. Historically, if you looked around and the tribe was ignoring you, that was not good news. Right. Because you would be gone in a week, right? And so we're very sensitive to that too. So those two things co-mingle, and we end up with the behaviors we have now. The thing that's important to understand is until the last couple hundred years, it hasn't been important to save. Number one, the average person back 100,000 years ago lived to be about 20 or in the mid-20s. In 1900 in America, the average person lived to be 50. And we had intact families, intact communities. So the old lived with the young, and they all sort of lived and survived, and everybody supported each other. And of course, that's all gone now. And so that's why it's so important to save now, is we have to take care of ourselves. And that's really a relatively recently, in terms of human history, that's a new need. And our brains are going like, okay, this is not, you know, it's having that problem, right?
Well, so then now
trying to make it work.
Yeah, right. So then I'm thinking, of course, then the next domino, Dr. Klontz, is to some degree, then we have to trick ourselves.
Absolutely. They're called brain hacks in today's culture, which means we are not going to change that basic program in your lifetime and my lifetime. We're just not going to do it. It's hardwired. It's also hardwired to do other things. For example, if I don't know it's there, then I don't pay attention to it. So one of the things that Ally has done essentially is we're going to take the money. You're going to know about it ahead of time, but you won't notice it in that moment. The federal government does this too. It's like it keeps your savings for you. Now, the money goes back to them, So they're really interested in your saving, right? And Social Security, the same thing. It's an enforced savings. We have no access to it. And so we tend to do better with that. It's like we can't get to it. And they're sort of doing it on our behalf.
Well, and then we feel good later because we've saved a bunch of money and now we're keeping up with the Joneses again. So we feel like we've done our part there as well. And we're not a burden to somebody else.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way another brain hack is I'm saving it for something that really matters to me. So I will have a picture of my son walking across the graduation stage in college. So every time I look at that, it's like, oh, that's the vision. Because that part of our brain is really interested. And the only way it really changes things is if we can see it, smell it, touch it, taste it. It's a very sensory organ.
Yeah.
And that's what it means. And so just the fact that we should save doesn't have much impact, if any, on that part of the brain.
We totally agree at Ally. I mean, that's what we've seen in a lot of our research too, was that when you talk to people about their dreams and their aspirations from life, and they have a deep rooted emotional connection to those things. But then when they log on and just see a savings account with a balance, that emotional connection was completely missing. And so that's one of the reasons why we started down the path of creating these tools, is how do we create that emotional connection to their savings account?
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you about, Emily. I think sitting here talking to Dr. Klontz myself, you guys getting together with him at Ally, this must have been fun. I mean, regardless of the fact that you're helping people save, just having these discussions must have been a really good time trying to figure out how do we make this all work together.
Yeah, the part that was very cool was they did their research. I have mine. And it's like, oh, we both came up with the same conclusions, which to me adds validity to the whole thing.
Yeah.
And the whole idea is the more personal we can make it, the more emotional we can make it. So when I talk to people about retirement, it's like, where will you be? What will you be doing? Who will you be with? What won't you have to do? What will you be able to do? And they'll go, well, you know, that's like, no, where would you be actually?
Yeah.
So that the more they can dream it, it's sort of like showing everybody your slides from Italy, the pictures. After you get done showing them, you want to go back again. you've re-motivated yourself. Yeah. And that's exactly the tool. That's one of the hacks, is we can see it, we can taste it, we can smell it, and then we're willing to delay our gratification.
Well, Emily, let's bring you back into the discussion. So you're working with Dr. Klontz. I can't imagine the test tubes at Ally. You guys are creating some tools about what are we going to do with this. Tell me what you guys came up with.
We found two pervasive themes in all those conversations and even talking to Dr. Klontz about what we found. And it was really simple. We knew people needed to help organize and then they needed to help to automate. And so on the organization aspect, we knew, and going back to that emotional connection that Dr. Klontz just walked through, we knew we needed to create some visual and highly personal ways for people to tell us what their priorities were that kind of morphed this basic savings account and how we traditionally communicate that into this highly emotional and personal experience for them. So we have developed a tool that allows people to actually tell us what their priorities are. And if you think about kind of the old envelope method where people kind of wrote on an envelope what they were saving, we've created the digital version of that. So they can go in and take their savings account. And instead of just seeing savings account, they can see it's Susie's college fund or visiting mom this summer or early retirement. And so on that front, we think just creating that highly visual and personalized experience will really help them feel more organized. And on the automation journey, we know there's two different kinds of savers: the people who kind of know that they have a regular amount that they can save on a regular basis, which unfortunately is not majority of Americans. And we try to really put front and center how they can create an automated and recurring transfer, either by doing that directly from their payroll or direct deposit right into a savings account, or just through a recurring transfer from their savings to checking. And if they don't have the willpower to do that, we developed a tool that kind of does it on their behalf, and we call it surprise savings. But what it does is look at somebody's income, their expenses, their upcoming bills, and really tries to identify those right moments to save, where it's safe to save, and move that money automatically from their checking account into their savings account. And what they get out of that is it takes the sense of stress of having to do it off of them and puts that burden on us. And it gives them the comfort of knowing that that money is just in their savings. So if they did have a need, it's there and they can always get it back.
Boy, I've got questions about all of that. But let's start off with what you said about recurring savings, Emily, because it surprises me that somebody would say, I don't have the willpower to set up recurring savings. I mean, I was a financial planner for 16 years, and I found that once we set it and it went away between my client and I, it seemed like 99.9% of the time, once that money started flowing into savings automatically, nobody ever called me to say, Joe, I have an emergency. I need to turn that back off again.
That's right. And that's why automation is so key. And if you think about even, you know, the marketing that employers do around 401k, they know if you can just get somebody to enroll, they're never going to turn that enrollment off. And so it is. It's, and I'm sure Dr. Klontz, you have something to add on this too, but it's just that initial step of turning it on. But once it's on, it stays on in perpetuity for most people. So it is really critical just to get them to take that step.
The more automatic we can make it, the more frictionless we can make it on the front end. The other thing that you talked about, the development of this concept, the way I see it is this is the beginning of a longer range plan. How do we allow them or how do we encourage them to not take it out prematurely? There are methods and means that we can use to do that, make it a little more difficult, maybe a little stickier where they have to take two or three steps. So they're less likely to do it. One of the things that we've learned about the 401k automatic saving, it worked really good until they look down and 2 years from now, they got $18,000 in their 401k and they go, boat.
Yeah.
Now.
Yes. Right? Yeah, yeah.
And so each of these things presents wonderful opportunities. Like, well, how do we help them to the next step? Ally is moving ahead already with phase two, phase three. I'm guessing we haven't really talked much about that, but I think what they'll run into is the same thing that caused them to say, we need to do something. It's like, okay, so we've done this. It's been really successful. How do we sustain this? How do we help them grow? And that kind of thing. And that's really what I like about Ally is like they get the big picture. And in the long run, everybody comes out a winner. It's yeah. a good thing. We're literally changing the cultural expectations.
I'm wondering, Dr. Klontz, it seems to me that based on what you said, when Emily talks about setting up recurring savings and your point about making sure you get that set up, that every time that you cut an expense, like let's say that you cut out the cable bill or you switch your cell phone so it's less expensive, like it seems like to me, based on everything you said, it's super important in that moment to capture that money right then. Otherwise, your brain gets a hold of it and who knows where it goes.
Well, from what I understand, that's exactly what Ally does. Like when the checkbook or the whatever gets to a certain level, they automatically move it.
Yeah.
With the consent of the client.
And that's the surprise savings piece of it right there.
That's right. And I do believe that we see in our research over and over that if we didn't have the ability to move that money on their behalf, people see that balance and they want to go out and spend it. It's like, you know, when you walk down the street and you see a sale and you never intended to spend money on that, but in your mind, you're saving money. And so you're going to walk in and you end up spending a bunch that you never would have spent otherwise. And so we think that there is a lot of power in grabbing money when we recognize that, you know, there is an opportunity to do that, because most people will save it if you don't.
The thing that Dr. Klontz said about putting some barriers between you and your money, I know that worked for me when I was a financial planner. I would set up accounts. You know, this is back when it was a little bit harder and we didn't have all the online access. We would set up in Detroit accounts in Minneapolis specifically because it was a long ways away, right?
And exactly.
If you needed your money, you could get it by check, or you could wait for an ACH, which would take a couple of days. But if you had it wired, it was going to be the wire fee, which was roughly $15. And I'll tell you, Dr. Klontz, to your point, if there was $15 between you and your money, your brain came up with a different way. It always did. But Emily, I would imagine it's difficult for you guys to implement something like that without people thinking you're the bad guy. Like, I could do it because I was a middleman and my client was in on it. But how are you guys thinking about creating those barriers?
Yeah, I think it's an important question. And I will tell you that we've heard in a lot of our research, a lot of people have their checking accounts at branches all over the United States, but they're still using us as a savings platform. And a lot of that feedback when we ask, well, why did you pick Ally? And a lot of people is well, it's one step removed from where I spend most of my money. Yeah. And so I do think that people have inevitably in their mind created a moment of friction with us because we are a digital bank that's not necessarily hooked to a lot of their other, you know, spending accounts. And so I think that people create their own hacks. I do think from a brand standpoint, we try to make it as easy as possible right. for people to get to their money. You know, we don't ever want people to think that we've locked it up in a vault, because we do make it very accessible. But I do think that we are trying to create moments of truth for people to really evaluate that decision and be mindful of whether it's the right thing to do for them.
Yeah. And I would say also that when the buckets have names or pictures on them, it reminds them of why we're the saving. It's like, oh, so it reduces the impulse to spend.
That's right. If you pull money out of going to visit your mom this summer, it's a personal affront to your mother if you say you'd rather have a TV instead of that trip. Yeah.
But sometimes that's a good thing. It just, you know, you yeah. need some distance.
I mean, maybe you really need that TV.
That's another show, right?
Yeah, that's right. Or the emotional mom stuff. I don't know. Yeah. Right. But this idea of setting up a buckets, Dr. Klontz, whether it's an ally or somewhere else, is can't be overstated. I think that putting names on everything instead of just, I own this mutual fund, I own this savings account, like those are nothing. If you attach them to your goals, I think it makes it much more tangible.
Yeah. Names are great. Pictures are even better, because the part of the brain that is the saver spender part is the sensory thing. So it responds, my grandchildren want to go to Mexico. So mom drew a palm tree. And it's on the refrigerator. And it's like every time they don't order out a pizza, $20 goes into that. And they can see it. No, it's sort of like everybody who's saving money. They show you where they want to be and where you are. And I know it shouldn't be that way, because we're really intelligent people. But basically, we are sensory people. When you go buy a car, they don't give you a list of cars for sale. They say, come with me. And they sit you down in the car, right? In the driver's seat.
Yes.
And this part goes, it's mine, it's mine. That part is about 6 or 7 years old, emotionally sophisticatedly. And the people who sell us things know that.
Yeah, well, you get the new car smell. You imagine yourself driving in it. Emily, I want to...
Did you know that a used car has that same smell?
No.
Yeah.
No used car I've been in has that same smell. Yeah.
So they know that. It's sort of like the smell of baking cookies when you walk into a house.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Buying. Oh, like, you're talking about on the lot, they spray it with that smell.
Absolutely.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah. I was going to say my kids' used cars smelled like old pizza and stuff that shouldn't be in there. Emily, I want to ask you one more question about, you guys call it buckets. I want to ask about how you do this at Ally. Is it actually separate accounts, or do I have one account and it's subdivided among a different, you know, different buckets?
It is one account subdivided among different buckets, so that we try to make it as easy on the user so they can look at their holistic savings balance and then see, you know, at an individual priority level, how much they've saved for each of those things.
And that is really cool. Emily, how do we find out more about it if people want to look into the boosters and buckets and surprise savings and getting some recurring savings started?
Yep, there is a lot of really good information on ally.com, and they can use that as their sort of, they want to learn about it.
Awesome. Emily Shalal, Dr. Ted Klontz, thanks for hanging out with us for a few minutes and talking about saving more money.
Yeah, thanks for being interested.
Thanks so much.
Hey there, spring lovers. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and holy cow, I forgot that yesterday was the first day of spring, and I'd planned this huge production down at the Sizzler of me balancing eggs. You know the drill on the Equinox, eggs balance perfectly, right? No? Ah, well, you go watch YouTube. It's all over the place. I mean, there's all kinds of videos about it, but I'm sure it's not quite too late, so let's try it out right here. I'll just, you know, it's like a day later, so I'll just give it a... Whoa. Oh, all right, that didn't work. One egg down. Okay, we're going to do this again, and check it. Whoa! I thought I had that one. All right, it's no good. Anyway, we can probably turn this disaster into a trivia question somehow. Let me think about this for... how about this? How many eggs were in the world's biggest omelet? I'll be back with an answer and hopefully a better trick in just a moment.
All right, Marcus is not new to this game. He's played this one before. But for those of you new to this, we play the closest person to the answer. And the score at this juncture is Paula has one. There's no, that's a typo. Paula, that's got to be a typo.
Just one. I'm
one just once so far this year.
She's holding back on purpose, guys, for that dramatic last second three-pointer.
Everybody loves the underdog.
They totally do. So she's got one. Len, you weren't here last week, so Doc G played on your behalf. I think he owes you something because he came in second. He got close, but not it. OG actually won. Marcus, you're playing on behalf of OG. So OG has six. Len has five. Paula's got one. That means, Paula, you get to decide, do you want to guess first, in the middle, or last?
I will guess last.
All right. And Len, do you want to go in the middle or first?
I'll go in the middle.
There we go. That's very strange. So, Marcus, the world's largest omelet. How many eggs?
I'm going to go with 400 solid.
I thought you were going to say four.
Final answer.
I was sure you were going to say four. I'm going to go with four because the biggest omelet that I've had, I think I only had three. Len?
Wow. How big of an omelet? Let's see. Well, I guess to do this, I'd have to think, what's the biggest pan that's out there, right? What's the biggest omelet pan available? There's got to be some limit. I wish you would have asked, what's the biggest Snickers bar? Did you see that? They made somebody out there. I think it was in Texas, as a matter of fact.
Marcus, really?
They made the world's biggest Snickers bar just recently. Let's see. Oh, gosh. What'd Marcus say? 400?
400.
400. What would they use for a pan? I mean, because it's a fine line between an omelet and scrambled eggs, right? You gotta be careful.
That's right.
You gotta... 400. What would that look like? Oh, I don't know. I have no freaking clue. I'm going to go up an order of magnitude. I'm going to say 4,000.
4,000. There's a little delta between the two of those, Paula.
Just a slight one. Jeez. Well, if I get this wrong, I'll have egg on my face.
She still got it.
Oh, I'm here all week, kids. So my options realistically are either to guess 399, in which case I claim all of the answers that are less than 400, or to guess 401, in which case I guess the answers that are in that delta between 400 to 4,000.
Well, you get half of those. Well, Len would
get half of that.
Yeah, Len would have half.
So functionally, the question is, do I think that it was greater than or less than 400?
Well, or 4,001, right? You've got that one.
Yeah, I really don't think there's any possibility of that.
All right.
Well, that was part of my strategy. I mean, right? I've got to go high enough that you're not going to Chelsea Brennan me, right? That's right? You have to do that.
Well, I think she's going to Chelsea Brennan somebody anyway.
Well, she certainly is. It ain't going to be me.
Oh, you know I don't put all my eggs in one basket.
Oh. That's such
egg a egg stream.
You must be yoking right now.
Oh, you beat me to it.
Oh, this is punishment.
These jokes are so cracked. Marcus is like, what the hell am I doing here?
No, I know people are waiting for me to jump, and I've got nothing.
You can poach. Why don't you poach one from Paula? She seems to have a few.
I guess my brain is scrambled.
Oh. Hey, Marcus, 9 years of podcasting. This is where you end up, right here. Right here.
You crack me up, Joe.
Ninja status. Yes. All right, Paula. What's it going to be? Enough stalling.
Okay, well, my brain is fried. So.
You're just afraid of being beaten.
Oh, geez. More or less than 400.
Well, this is a no-brainer. You know the answer.
I'm gonna guess 401. Yeah, I'm going to guess 401.
Marcus, no offense. I think she's trying to take out OG. There, stay in the game.
I'm feeling confident enough. I've got a good, nice range.
We will tell you the answer, but in just a minute.
What if you too could be balding and own your own podcast production company? Think that would be too good to be true? Well, strap on the wow helmet, kids, because we're about to introduce you to Stacking Benjamins in the Can. Now, you too can create a moderately successful internet radio show from the comfort and privacy of your own mom's basement. That's right. Stacking Benjamins in the Can is the do-it-yourself kit that's creating tons of internet fun. What's included? Well, feast your eyes on this, kids. Open up your Stacking Benjamins in the Can, and you'll see 14 ways to talk about your latest trip to Bavaria. 18 of the worst bad dad jokes you ever heard. Your own barely relevant holiday calendar. A sealed container brimming with the smells of stale basement air and day-old pizza. Plus, one script chock full of segue ideas. And because there was still a little room, we also shoved in your very own Steak Brother story. All in the can. But that's not all. Think we can't do better? Oh, yes, we can. We've also thrown in the can 5 gratuitous references to OG's after-school activity, 3 boring tales about how cold it is in Detroit, and if you call in now, tons of free Sizzler coupons. How do you get it? You know that's not the question to ask. Oh, go ahead, ask us. How do I get it in the can? Here's the secret to Stacking Benjamins in the Can. Just head to your mom's basement, buy a microphone, and we'll take care of the rest. Stacking Benjamins in the Can couldn't be easier. Still not sold? What if I told you Stacking Benjamins in the Can is gluten-free? That's right. Healthy, barely funny, and all stuffed into this refillable souvenir container. Call for yours today. Operators are standing by. No animals were harmed in the making of this recording.
All right, Marcus, you've got pretty much 400 and below. That's a lot of eggs.
Yeah, I'm confident with this. I'm happy.
Paula, what?
Happy with these results.
Paula's got 401 to math in front of, people, not my strong suit. 3,600, so 1,800, so up to about 2,200.
You got a wide range.
2,200 eggs. You got everything north of 2,201, Mr. Penzo.
Yep, and I am ecstatic.
Of course you are. All right, Doug, what's our answer?
Hey there, cracked eggs. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and I'm back because I solved the issue. I'm going to use these cracked eggs to make omelets for everyone. You know how that politician way back when, probably like so far back, like before Joe's mom was even born, they talked about a chicken in every pot? Well, this is going to be, wait for it, an egg on every plate. It's totally different. Brilliant. I'll get working on t-shirts for that. But for you, how about this trivia answer? Here was a question. How many eggs were in the world's largest omelet? The answer? Back in 2012 in Portugal, it took 55 people, 6 hours, to make the world's biggest omelet. Pedro Mendez was the head chef overseeing the work, and you know, it's all great and everything, but how many eggs were in it? Well, how about this? 145,000. 145,000. That is a lot of cracking going on. Speaking of cracking, time for me to go hatch this plan with Joe's mom. I'm going to need some kitchen space and lots of butter. See ya!
Come on. Recount.
You got to be kidding me. Where was the pan they used?
Can you imagine how big that pan must have? And trying to flip that
How'd
thing.
How'd you flip it? Exactly.
Yes. 145,000. You guys are fighting over 400. maybe not quite there. So Mr. Penzo's back into a tie, and Paula makes the dramatic comeback even more dramatic.
Wow.
It's a long season.
It's gonna be fun. Hey, let's take out the magnifying glass, guys, and help somebody do better with their money. Today's hotline call comes to us courtesy of MagnifyMoney.com. You know what happens, Marcus, when you go to StackingBenjamins.com/MagnifyMoney?
something wonderful.
It is rainbows and roses. You find out those financial products you use every day at your brick and mortar bank, they are nowhere close to the best in class, because over 92% of all the products available online, all ranked at Magnify Money. StackyBenjamins.com/Magnify Money for more. So whether you're doing the refinance game like we talked about, trying to find the right high interest savings account, whatever it is, Magnify Money's got you covered. Today, by the way, we're going to help Joe. What a great name. We're going to help Joe magnify his money. Say hi, Joe.
Hey, Joe and OG. My name's Joe. I'm 25. I'm getting married in 5 weeks, and I'm in my first year of law school. My fiance works full-time and supports us. My question has to do with taxes. Because I'm a student, I can take advantage of the lifetime learning tax credit, which really decreases my tax liability. My hope was to bring my tax liability down to zero for 2019, but right now it's sitting at $145. My first thought was to make a $1,200 traditional IRA contribution to bring my tax liability to zero. I then thought, well, if I'm making an IRA contribution, shouldn't it be a Roth one? I was contributing to my Roth, but stopped about a year ago to save up money to live off of while in law school. The wrinkle in this is that my fiance and I plan to buy a house a little after I graduate, about 2.5 years from now. I estimate we'll have about $48,000 in savings at that time. This would be the perfect amount to buy a house in the $200,000 range, but we might want to buy a house in the $250,000 range, and I know this is bad, but dip into my Roth to cover the rest of the expenses for buying a house. So I'm torn on what to do. Put $1,200 in a traditional IRA to save $150 in taxes right now. Put $1,200 in a Roth IRA, pay some taxes, but get a much larger tax savings down the road. Or invest more in my Roth and take advantage of the big sale at the market right now. But the more we invest, the less cash we'll have for a down payment on a house. Can't wait for my shirt.
Sometimes I wonder if it's actually about the question or if it's about a t-shirt. Marcus, what's your first thought when you hear Joe's question there?
First thought is congratulations on the marriage.
Yeah.
Second thought is there's no wrong answer. I think we've all seen HGTV where they walk in with a $50,000 budget and walk out with a $1.5 million house. So I'm actually going to go with the house. It's 2 years, a 2-year sacrifice, $48,000 in savings he said he might have. I think it's an emotional benefit, newlywed couple. Final answer, I'm saying go with the house.
But if he gets into the house that's the big expensive house, you know, we talked about that earlier, though, Marcus, that immediately is a lot of outflow every month.
I was banking on the lawyer money. So I'm optimistically thinking that he'll have a 2-income household at that time. Plus, he's putting a significant down payment, unlike most people who either don't have the 20% down or, I mean, that's actually a little bit more. That's actually 40% down if they can save up to that amount. So I'm banking on, I guess, 3 things here. 1, happy newlywed couple buying something and establishing a life for themselves with that emotional down payment, although it is a physical down payment in the form of a house. $48,000 that he estimated they could save. I'm estimating that they hit that. He had quite the range there. He had an HGTV range of $200,000 to $250,000. So the only thing that I would say there is I read this from the Millionaire Next Door. They said if you are not wealthy yet and want to be wealthy in the future, not to buy a home more than 2 times your annualized income. So whatever that is or whatever their annualized income is there, making sure that it's, I think a lot of these questions are, make sure that you buy something you can actually afford. And I think that's where people fail. And it sounds like they're on the right path here. So I'm going to stick with the home answer. I'm rooting for this couple.
Len, what do you think?
Well, I'm confused. I mean, is the $48,000 that he's got, he will have saved, is that, was that in the Roth or was that outside of the Roth?
That's savings account money.
That's savings account money, right?
Yeah.
So, and he said that that's going to be his down payment. My goodness, that's great. You know, if he puts money in his Roth, Joe can withdraw. He can withdraw that $1,200 with no penalties, right? You can withdraw your contributions. Plus, you can withdraw another $10,000 worth of earnings that I believe are exempt from penalties and taxes, right? So, you know, I don't think it's a big deal to go ahead and put the $1,200 in the Roth and pull. If you need that extra $1,200 later, pull it out because you ain't going to be penalized for it, right?
He puts it, if he puts it in the Roth, he'll still have the tax. He'll still have the same tax issue that he's talking about. But
well, he'll still owe us 145 tax liability.
He'll
right?
still owe the 145.
Yeah, that's, I don't know. Maybe it's just the point of life I'm in. I'm like $145 tax. I mean, it's $145. That's like, oh, I don't know. That's, I don't know. That just, to me, it's not worth worrying about $145.
Did you think that, Marcus, when you heard it, were you worried about the $145?
I was not, especially stretched out over 2 years, so it was a little under 300. And that's kind of what I'm looking at here. In either one of these scenarios, what he described anyway, he's talking about 2 years. And I think that's both plenty of time to self-correct when you're talking about a 40-year potentially retirement or 47 years to save. He's 25 now. Or if he puts in the Roth for 2 years. I just feel like 2 years, he's got a lot of flexibility and a lot of cash to work with here. He's flush with options, which a lot of people don't have.
Paula, as my mom says, what are you thinking, Lincoln?
Definitely put money in the Roth for a few reasons. Number one, he's in a lower tax bracket right now than he will be in the future. Once he graduates from law school, hopefully, if everything goes according to plan, he will have a job that will bring in a good income. And that means he will be in a much higher tax bracket. So don't worry about the taxes that you're going to pay right now, because you're going to be in a low, hopefully, the time in which you are in law school, these next few years will be the lowest tax bracket time of your life until you reach retirement. So put your money in a Roth now. Plus, not only are you in a lower tax bracket now, but also you'll get a lifetime of benefit from all of the compounding gains, the dividends, the appreciation, everything that accrues inside of that Roth. Now, I also don't think it's necessarily a good idea to buy a house right after law school, because right out of law school, you don't know what job you're going to accept, where you're going to work. You might accept a job and end up hating it. And after 3 months at that job, or after 6 months at that job, you can't stand your boss anymore. You can't stand your supervisors, and you want to quit that toxic office environment and switch to a different place. I don't know how location specific your fiance's work is. Maybe you'll stay in the same city. Maybe you'll end up moving to a different city for either one of your jobs. Like, there's so much that happens, so much that's up in the air after graduating, that I think there's some wisdom to maintaining flexibility for at least a year or two after you graduate with your terminal degree, so that you can figure out where you're going to work. And so that if you do end up accepting a job with a toxic work environment and you want to quit, you have the freedom to quit and not be worried about the fact that you have a mortgage.
Did you own your place in Austin, Marcus?
I do not. I rent. And I guess one thing I'm looking at here is even if you did put that, and it was an estimate, if you put that $48,000 down, it would be in cash. So to Lynn's point, it might just make sense to earn interest on that. I guess that's one thing I wasn't thinking about here, that the interest, if he is going to put that in a savings account. I think I saw one for a high yield of 1.85 interest. I think they sent me a mail the other day. So he can definitely most likely beat that. I'm saying that slowly because the market is down right now. Yeah. Everything's in red.
It's interesting, Len, what Paul is talking about, because you see people move all over now. I mean, you didn't have that experience, right? You've been able to stay in the same place for a fairly long time.
Yeah, and I'm lucky. But you know what? When I started, you usually had to transfer. So it's like, there's a lot of, even if you stay with the same company, a lot of times you'd have to transfer to a different place. But you know what's really nice now is the internet and all the, there's so much more flexibility. And if a company really wants you, they will, and you can do your work from home. Yeah, you've got so much more flexibility now. So you're kind of that risk of being stuck in a house and you have to move, maybe you're upside down or something or whatever, and you can't sell it. You know, that's kind of less lessened now just because the times have changed. So
I totally agree. I mean, I remember Diana Merriam being on from the Economy Conference, and that she had, was able to move to Cincinnati, able to move to Paula's hometown.
Hey.
So still, I love the idea of keeping flexibility. And I thought that was also the right question to ask. I thought the tax question myself was not the question I would have been asking, especially since, and just to frame my answer, it's, I never want the tax situation to wag the dog. I don't want to worry about taxes so much that I don't do the thing that's my real goal. You know, I remember one guy here in Detroit used to always say, I want to have Bill Gates' tax bill. That is my goal. My goal is not to pay less tax. My goal is to have more money. Of the two, I'm always going to go for a higher tax bill because I have more cash. That said, you want to make a smart move. But I think that to some of the points that I heard earlier with the lawyer salary coming, the changing financial position coming, the house coming, all those things are gonna really change your situation. So I also was not that worried about the tax today.
Yeah, Joe sounds like he's in great, him and his wife are in great shape. And I think the $145 tax liability is the least of his problems.
Yeah. Thanks for the question, Joe. You got a question for us? Head to stackybenjamins.com/voicemail and you can have the gang pitch in to answer your question too. Well, that's going to do it for today. Let's talk about what's going on where all of you guys work and play. We'll have the guest of honor go last. So Len, what's happening over at lenpenzo.com?
I have another $40,000 challenge person, and this is somebody from Boston, Massachusetts. Really, really interesting, living for $40,000 in the Boston area. So quite fascinating, quite
wow.
Fascinating.
$40,000 in Boston. What color is their tent?
Matt from Massachusetts, huh?
I said living on $40,000 in Boston. What color is their tent?
Oh, yeah. Oh, by the way, I'm lying. It's $45,000.
$45,000.
Okay. Still, give the guy some credit.
Well, that makes all the difference, that extra $5,000. he's living the high life. Marcus talks about being a baller. There it is. Right. I love those, by the way. Those, how people make it work on $45,000. Paula, what's happening at Afford Anything?
On the Afford Anything podcast, we have an interview with Jillian Johnsrud, who talks about how she reached financial independence on a very small salary. And we have an interview with Chris Guillebeau, who just wrote a fiction book about side hustles, entrepreneurship, and money management. Ah. So both Jillian and Chris appear on the Afford Anything podcast, available wherever finer podcasts are downloaded.
Not the places you'd find this horrible podcast, but way better places. Actually, sadly for Paula, she has to be at the same places where you get this one. Yeah, tough.
Actually, you know, there's a guy by the name of Joe Saul Sehi who joins me about one out of every four episodes.
Brilliant episodes.
The best quarter of our episodes ever.
Everybody goes by those people like Jillian and Chris. I mean, who cares about those people and their epic stories when you can get more Joe and his pedantic nonsense?
It's just filler in between the episodes in which you're on.
I thought you were going to say mine is just all filler all the time. And so all you fans of filler. Yeah. Marcus, thanks for hanging out with us again, man. Every time you're on, I think we don't get to talk to you enough.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me.
Let's talk first about what's going on at the podcast. Because you guys just talked to our mutual friend Cassandra at the podcast. Well, actually, Rich did. He kicked you to the curb.
Yeah, actually, Rich will be holding it down. Like I told my employer, I'm traveling to one of these questionable countries where the corona is currently.
Oh.
I'm waiting to see if the plane is going to get canceled or not. So it's going to be one of two things. Either you see me here next week, and that's not good news. Or you don't see me here in 2 weeks, and that's not good news.
Either way, it's not good news.
But either way, Rich will be holding it down at Paychecks and Balances. You can find everything you need at paychecksandbalances.com, where we help millennials make money, save money, and get out of debt. Rich will hold down the smooth sounds of Paychecks and Balances.
It drives me crazy. That is so awesome. If I had your voice, I'd burn mine. but let's talk about your book, about the awesome book. Book sales have been strong, I'm sure.
Yeah, the book is Debt Free or Die, Trying How I Buried Myself in $30,000 in Debt and Dug My Way Out by Age 30. I gave some ruminations on the show here. 30s are getting further and further behind, and so it gets harder and harder to remember the book. So I'm rewriting a second edition with updates and calls to action and everything you need to know. I used to direct people all over the internet, and now it's just themarcusgarrett.com. Everything you need to know, all my social medias, as well as the book, second edition coming soon.
We will link to the book and to Paychecks and Balances if you're on your commute or walking the dog at our show notes page at stackybenjamins.com. Actually, we'll link to everybody's awesome stuff at stackybenjamins.com. But Len, Marcus was talking about remembering 30. You remember 30. That was when you used to change the wheels on the horse and buggy, wasn't it?
Hey, thanks, Joe. And you know what? You had your horse and buggy too. We're not that far apart, my friend. By the way, Marcus, you're not the only one with the in front of your name. I have thepersistentitch.com. So don't
take that, Marcus. Take that.
There's actually another Marcus who's dominating the Google homepage, and a basketball player that I hope doesn't go to the NBA or I'll never make it to the homepage.
The only guy you watch playing basketball where you're like, break your leg. Come on, break your leg.
I've been rooting against him for the last 15 years.
It's evil. All right, that's going to do it. Doug, you've got it from here, man. What should we have learned today?
So what should we have learned today? Take some advice from our team. Sure, spring might be just another season, but it's a great time to clean out all of those bad habits. Second, listen to what Dr. Klontz had to say. Not saving enough? Might be time to check your behaviors. What are you doing to sabotage yourself? But the big lesson? Don't let Joe's mom discourage you against making omelets for all your supporters. An egg on every plate, I tell ya, even if I gotta crack them all myself. #Doug2020. Just like every other candidate, I have no clue how I'm gonna get this done, but we'll find a way if you vote me in. I promise. Special thanks to Marcus Garrett from Paychecks and Balances for joining our roundtable discussion. You'll find the Paychecks and Balances podcast wherever you're listening to us right now. Paula Pant appears courtesy of affordanything.com and the Afford Anything podcast. Len Penzo, the captain of skepticism, appears courtesy of lenpenzo.com. This show is created by Joe Saul Sehi, produced by Karen Rapine, and engineered by the amazing Steve Stewart. Online, visit us on Twitter at SBenjaminsCast or on our Facebook page. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and I swear the worst part about coming over to Joe's mom's house is having to put on pants. SB Podcasts may receive payment on the show from sponsors and guests in the form of books, giveaway items, discounts, or other remunerations. That's a big word. There's no way you take advice from these dorks, but like Joe's mom always says, don't take advice from people you don't know. This show is for entertainment purposes only. And before making any financial decisions, consult with a real financial advisor. Hey, how come I always have to say the amazing Steve Stewart? That Richie kid's pretty cool, and we don't add any adjectives before his name. What about me? How come I'm never the incomparable neighbor Doug, or the unimaginably cool neighbor Doug, or even the unfathomably intelligent neighbor Doug? This place sucks.
All right, Doug talked about omelets, and I can't make omelets without making a huge mess in the kitchen, just a monster mess. But everybody, I think, well, maybe not everybody, but I kind of think most people have this complete mess in the kitchen that's just a delicious recipe. And I thought that we would have the Stacking Benjamins recipe time here during the after show. So, big mess in the kitchen. And while you guys are thinking about it, I'll go first. I make this beef and broccoli that is absolutely fantastic. It's incredible. I make the beef separate from the broccoli, like a lot of people put them together. I will make the beef first And it's a bunch of cornstarch, a lot of peanut oil, red pepper, red wine, hoisin sauce, clam sauce, and soy sauce. But a bunch of cornstarch. You sit it in cornstarch at room temperature for about half an hour beforehand. And oh my, it's so good. But when I get finished with that, my entire kitchen is just an absolute mess. Paula?
So I make my own pesto. I grow the basil plants on my kitchen counter. And then I combine in a food processor, basil leaves, pine nuts, Parmesan cheese, or if I'm out of that, I'll use cheddar as a substitute, even though that's not as good. Olive oil, salt, lemon juice, garlic. I add red chili pepper flakes, which is unusual, but I think it gives it a little kick, makes it taste better. But the reason, like, it theoretically, everything's going into the food processor, which is then capped. So theoretically, it shouldn't make a mess, unless you are like me, and every few seconds, you stop, taste it, and then decide, like, needs a little more salt, or needs a little more lemon juice. And if you do that enough times, as I do, you end up getting pesto all over the counter. So
there's and it really isn't about tasting or testing it, is it? It's not about testing it. It's about Paula having pre-meal.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. No, I always make minor adjustments. You know, I taste it and be like, oh, I added too much garlic. Better counteract that by putting in more of all of the other ingredients.
Len, this is making me hungry. We shouldn't have done this.
Well, I make lots of messy meals, but I'll tell you when I got just the other day. Oh my God, it made such a mess. And I'll tell you why after. But it was it's a fettuccine shrimp mushroom creamy pasta. Oh, it was so freaking good. And it's there's shrimp, like a pound and a half of shrimp. There's minced garlic, basil, paprika, red pepper flakes, Paula.
Yeah. There.
Fresh mushrooms. Then there's the cream, right? You got to get the half and half, pour that in for the cream. Shredded Parmesan, shredded mozzarella. What you do first to get the whole thing started in the pan, you put the olive oil in and you get that going. Well, here's what I did. And this took me by surprise. You put the olive oil in, you get it hot. You put the mushrooms in, get those all cooked up. Get the mushrooms out just for a second, and then you put the shrimp in. Well, dummy me did not pat the shrimp down first. They were kind of wet.
Yeah,
you know
what
I'm saying? When
they always tell you to pat them down first.
Yeah, but I didn't. So there's water on the shrimp, really, residual, and I dumped it into the pan of olive oil. And you know what happens when you get hot oil and water, it exploded, and the oil just went – just poofed, and it went everywhere. Oh my God, what a mess. It was worth it. The food was good, but the mess afterwards, that oil was just everywhere. So make sure you pat your shrimp down.
And that's the lesson of what happened to Len's hair.
Right there. Thank God I didn't have any hair, or it would have been gone.
He would have had tips, would have had all kinds of fiery tips in the end of his hair. All right, Marcus. For the win, man. Best macaroni and cheese ever.
Yeah, exactly. You save your worst for last, because I was reflecting over my culinary, you know, delights, and I realized I couldn't even come up with a recipe. And often for me, and I guess my fellow millennials, it's a mean, what they think is a delivery, but it's actually DiGiorno. So that's about the only thing that is repeatedly DiGiorno. Cooked in this house. There's always a DiGiorno in the freezer. There's actually two in the freezer right now. Falling into my 50-30-20 budget. I don't cook. I don't know why I went last, and I don't have a single recipe to refer to. Sometimes I put extra pepperoni if they try to jip me on the DiGiorno. But
Marcus, you know what you've got to do, my friend? You've got to make pizza almost every Friday night. We have the Honeybee and I have our pizza night, and it's homemade. And you know what? Invest in a bread machine. And it'll make the dough for you. And it's just, it's all downhill from there. And it's so much better than DiGiorno. Just, it's awesome.
I will say this. If I survive the corona, I'll get the bread maker.
Well, the other alternative, if you go to Trader Joe's, they sell like little bags of dough that you can use in order to make your own pizza. So if you want to make your own pizza, but you don't want to go through the step of making your own dough, you can get this like 99-cent bag from Trader Joe's of dough, roll it out, get a pizza stone, and then you roll it out on a pizza stone. What I like to do, put the pizza stone in the oven first.
Yes.
Get it hot, then put the dough on it, and then cover that dough with all kinds of toppings. I recommend pesto. And and it's just a very simple way to make your own pizza without having to make the dough.
And how long do you let that pizza stone soak in the oven for at temperature, Paula, before you start?
Oh, like maybe 10, 15 minutes. I just want to get it hot.
Try it an hour. That's to me the secret. If you want a nice crispy crust, you let that pizza stone soak for like an hour at temperature. And then, oh my God, it's so good. That's the secret to a pizza stone, using that pizza stone. Get it super hot.
Does that just make it crispier on the bottom? Is that what it
does?
Oh
my God, so good. Yeah. Oh yeah, super crispy. If you like a crispy crust.
Sure. Oh yeah. Whenever my mom would go out of town and my dad cooked, I knew we were either going to have, and it didn't matter what time of day it was, we were going to have French toast or goulash. Like, who the hell makes only two things and goulash is one of the two? You know what I mean?
I love goulash.
I do love goulash, but I knew it was either French toast, not French toast for dinner, or goulash for dinner. It's going to be one of the two. Yeah.
My dad literally never cooked. Like, I remember when I was a kid, when my grandfather died, my mom had to fly back to Kathmandu. And during that time, there was just this like parade of family friends that would come drop off meals at the house because my dad was incapable of cooking. And literally, I'm not even joking. A few years ago, I flew back to Atlanta where my parents live to go visit them. And my dad, who at this point is like in his 70s and retired and has absolutely nothing better to do and therefore has like no excuse for why he doesn't cook. You know, my dad was like, oh, would you like a glass of water or a cup of tea or something? And I'm like, yeah, sure. That'd be great. And then he like kind of looks around the kitchen blankly. And it turns out he doesn't know where the glasses or the mugs are kept. Like, he's lived in this house since 2007. And he doesn't know where the water glasses or the coffee mugs, tea mugs are kept.
That's the perfect existence right there.
Easy now, Paula. You know, when you get older, you just forget.
He never learned it in the first place.
Speaking from experience.
I thought, Paula, when your mom was out of town, your dad was going to look at you and go, want a DiGiorno? And we bring it like full circle.
Oh, gee, I know you're already a member, but I wonder if the rest of our audience knows that becoming a member at Navy Federal Credit Union could help you save and earn more. Their certificate options could earn you more than standard savings accounts with competitive rates. Not all financial institutions offer you as many choices for savings options as Navy Federal does. For example, you could start your savings journey with a low minimum deposit, add money at any time, and watch your savings grow. Thanks to flexible terms, you can use Navy Federal's savings option for all kinds of goals, short or long term. Considering a big home improvement project, maybe you want to consolidate debt. You could borrow up to 100% of your home's equity with a fixed-rate home equity loan with zero closing costs, or easily borrow as you go with a home equity line of credit. Both options could help make life's big expenses seem more manageable. To learn more, visit NavyFederal.org. At Navy Federal, our members are the mission. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender. Membership required. Terms and conditions apply. Loan subject to approval.